WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Bryant Rozier from Fort Wayne Inkspot on the topic of journalism. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. In the movie Big Fish, a father and son talk about how they are both storytellers. Their methods differ. One speaks his stories aloud, the other writes his down. But they're doing the same thing, telling stories. It's appropriate to start off this conversation with a movie reference, as we will begin our conversation with films, directors, and screenwriters that have been influential in the life of my next guest, Bryant Rozier from the Fort Wayne Inkspot. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ben.
Now, you and I are going to spend our time together speaking about journalism, but in order to explain how your writing style developed, we need to start with movies.
Yeah, like a lot of people don't know this, and it's not something I talk about, but I actually went to Ball State for film studies, or at least a minor in film studies. That's what I got out of it when I graduated. So I've been kind of this quote-unquote film snob since I was 19, 20 years old. Like, as I've gotten older, I've gotten out of that more, but I spent a lot of time in college and a lot of time before that just watching a lot of movies. And those films growing up, the films that when I was 18 to now, influenced my style of writing. Spike Lee is probably the biggest name black filmmaker of anyone my age. I'm 40 years old, so I saw Spike's first movie around the time it came out. You know, I'm still watching this stuff now. And Spike Lee has his style of writing where it's less traditional, it's more conversational. Like, he'll sneak in popular culture references, you know, just regular folk talk. Quentin Tarantino is another example of that, where in QT's work, you know, is very popular culture reference heavy. A lot of people see that as a negative, like he's just being cool for the sake of cool. It's not really that case, especially with my writing. What I try to do is when you make a reference to something, you're trying to explain something hugely complicated in a truncated form to make it accessible for other people. The best example I have with QT, with Quentin Tarantino's work, where in Pulp Fiction, everyone knows the scene in Pulp Fiction with Marvin gets shot in the face. Jules has to get on the phone to see who can help us in this area. And he's talking to Vincent. And he basically says, without using cuss words, he says, I hope my boy Jimmy is at home because I don't have any friends in the 818. Now, he's on the phone and he has to call someone in the 818. 818 is the designated area code for where he was. Hello? And he's not saying 818 because he's trying to be cool. Now, it sounds cool coming out of Sam Jackson's mouth, like everything does. Exactly. But he's more or less trying to, in a very quick way, relatable way, saying, hey, look, we're in this zip code. I don't know anybody else who I have to call that has an 818 error code. It's just a shortcut way of saying something. What's the alternative? Hey, look, dude, I don't know anybody who lives in this area of town that could help us. Like, you're just going to say, hey, give me an 818. I live in the 06 zip code. If I'm trying to talk to you and you ask me where I live, I said, I live in the 06. You're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. It's just a shortcut, truncated way of explaining something that's really kind of complicated with someone who knows what I'm talking about. That's my writing style. That's actually kind of what I do. This advice is not for everybody. Most people, if you take the traditional route of writing, that's cool. But this is kind of how I did it. I learned from watching movies. I learned from reading comic books. I learned from my dad. You know, I tend to write the way my dad talked to me, or at least how I remembered he talked to me. Maybe he didn't talk as, you know, colorful. Maybe he talked way more colorful than I remember. I don't know, but this is kind of the version of a conversation I had with my dad that I've had for years that I can no longer have because he obviously passed in 2007. My style of writing is really kind of conversational through so many influences, my dad being my primary go-to. My dad would quote the Bible and James Brown in the same sense. And that's how I grew up. I grew up thinking that was normal. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that, but like you, if you try to write that way in a school paper, you would get, you know, points taken away. But like, it's funny, once you get out of school, once you kind of get away from that world, you can actually make a living writing conversationally. And it's something that, like, I grew up that I just think is the most normal thing is to kind of have. I like the juxtaposition of fancy big college encyclopedia words with like cuss words, with like regular words. You know, I like how they sound. I get that feeling of hearing those words clashing against each other from my dad, from growing up just being like, you know, I'm a quiet guy. I grew up just not talking, but just listening to him talk. And I would say like one word, I'll say, yes, I agree. That's funny. You're crazy. You know, I would say just one word. I'd just let him talk for paragraphs of information, just let him go. And that's kind of how I grew up. It's kind of filtered in how I write.
You write how you speak. I've had a similar experience when reading stories from NPR hosts and reporters. Often you hear their voices in your head when you read their work. The written word and the spoken word flow together.
Exactly. Another example of what I've taken from the world for my writing style that may or may not work for everybody else is the idea of honesty. My favorite way to explain that is one of my favorite shows of all time. I like absurd humor. I love 30 Rock. Tracy Jordan, the quintessential doofus character who falls butt backwards into celebrity and millions of dollars. He's kind of an idiot. But Tracy can be brutally honest. It's one thing about his character. He has no filter. He doesn't know when he should stop. So the idea that a Tracy Jordan character would just forget to go to the hospital when his kids are being born makes complete sense if you think about who Tracy Jordan is. In one particular episode of the show, Tracy Jordan is listing reasons why he didn't go to his kid's birth. One of the reasons was, I forgot. I think it was something to the effect of, first reason was, I'm going to a karate tournament. The second reason was, I forgot. It's a very honest statement if you think about who Tracy Jordan is, but it's also a very truncated, shortcut way of explaining something about this character. Again, they're not trying to be funny for the sake of being funny. They're taking an aspect of a character, something that he would normally do, and they're making that part of it funny. It's just honesty. It's just the most honest way of Tracy Jordan to say, hey, dude, I just forgot to go to the hospital. Like, it's me, Tracy Jordan. I've tried to incorporate that, just the most direct to the point way of saying something, whether you're trying to be funny or you're just trying to make a point when you write something. That's something I've kind of taken to heart. It's something I kind of do pretty much all the time. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes someone reads your stuff and, well, you could have written that. You could have written that more eloquently. You could have written that, you know, in a longer sentence. I'm like, or I can just be honest and say, I forgot.
And once you've formed yourself as a writer and once what you're putting to the page is an honest reflection of your personality and everything that's formed your style to that point, you need to have an audience, a readership, or perhaps more importantly, a publisher who responds well to your writing and your style.
One of my creative writing professors at Ball State set me aside one day and we were having this kind of, you know, this impromptu meeting. And she said, you're going to have to find an editor who responds to the way that you write. Because even back then I had a style. Even back then I was doing those things that Spike Lee taught me, Quentin Tarantino taught me, my dad taught me, all my family members who are like my dad taught me. I had like an earlier version of what you're reading for me now. I had that kind of back then. And she knew that. And she read my stuff and she's like, dude, you're great. But you're going to have to find somebody who responds to your work because not everybody is going to be down with how you write. And that's kind of one of the tricky things of having a style is you have to find your style, but you have to find a home for it. That could be a tricky thing. It helps if you're the publisher of your own newspaper and you can just assign stories to yourself. You have to worry about a publisher or an editor. I'm my own editor. Nobody's checking me. But there have been times, obviously, that I've written for other publications. So I had to kind of find those areas and find those editors who kind of responded the way I work.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Bryant Rozier, and this episode is Journalism, Lesson 2. We started with movies, and we are going to stick with visual media for a little while longer. When I first reached out to you about being a guest instructor, I didn't realize how much experience you have had in photography.
I've had kind of two lives. I'm living the second life now as a writer, but the first part of my tenure in Fort Wayne, maybe the first 8 years as a professional artist, people know me as a photographer, which is weird because I actually went to school for writing. Took one class at Ball State. And photojournalism, I got a C-. Didn't really learn anything. So then I graduated, bought my own film camera back then, and I kind of learned the old school way of just kind of like taking pictures, writing down the exposure, going to 1 hour photo mat, looking at it, and then learning that way. Photography has actually played a huge part in my life, but it's not my first love or anything like that. There are two kinds of photographers in the world. You're either an action photographer or you're more or less a portrait photographer. Action photographers, you're more or less shooting around what someone else is doing without you posing them, or you just have to kind of work around what someone else is doing. It's not for everybody. Some people love to kind of be in a studio and shoot flowers, and that's nothing wrong with that. That's great. If that's your passion, do your thing. I prefer people. I prefer being around people, and I didn't have a problem with just kind of going around shooting people, whatever they were doing. And it's funny, it's the weirdest thing. I'm not even a hockey fan. Like, I'm a baseball dude. But for some reason, I watched one Sports Century documentary in high school, and this kind of lesson kind of stuck with me. It was on Wayne Gretzky, of all people. Again, I'm not a hockey guy, but I know enough about hockey to know that he's the best ever. There's never going to be another Wayne Gretzky. You can debate Jordan, LeBron. You can't really do that with Wayne. He's the dude. He's the always guy. He's Wayne Gretzky. How he learned to play hockey, and this is straight from that documentary. You can go on YouTube and pull it up and watch it. He learned from his dad. His dad basically said, don't follow the puck. Go to where the puck is going. Don't be one of those kids who's just running around chasing the puck. Anticipate where the puck is going to be. Be there before everybody. Take it, run with it, and score. And it's something that, like, I'm watching it, and I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. Cut to 10, 15 years later, and I'm a photographer. I'm an action photographer, and I actually have to do that. I'm literally doing that without realizing it. And it took me years to figure out, why am I always in a position to take that shot? It's because I'm literally pre-visualizing what's happening. I'm understanding the scene. I'm understanding what's happening. Because if you understand the moment, you can actually anticipate where to be. Like, if I'm shooting an event, what's the event about? Who's the event for? Who else is celebrating this person if they're getting an award? All those, if you answer all those questions, all those questions tell you where to be so you can take that shot to get that moment. But this is photography and this is real life. So we're not posing anybody. The one thing that I've kind of learned is the idea of compromise, how compromise is cool. It's okay to not get the best shot because, again, this is, you're dealing with reality. If you're shooting action shots, you get to that moment, in that perfect moment in your head. You're getting there and you're standing there. You're like, okay, I got my shot. I know what I'm going to be. Then somebody walks in front of you. Like, what are you going to do? You can't just say, hey, lady, like, or dude, like, I'm the photographer. I'm here. What if you don't have time to politely ask them to move out of the way? What if the light is not exactly where you want it to be? What if the person at the last second decides to turn their head and that perfect shot is lost? What do? You're going to have to a degree, you're going to have to compromise. You're going to have to get the best version of what you have at that moment. And that's something that, like, as an action photographer, it's almost kind of par for the course. If you're not doing that, you're a sadist and you're driving yourself crazy because you're like, I got to get the perfect shot. Like, no, you don't. Get the best version of the perfect shot. Because more likely that person is going to turn their head back around again. The light's going to move to where you need it to be. The person that's in front of you is going to move because you're going to understand it's a photographer behind me. He's doing his job. You'll get that perfect moment maybe 2 seconds later. There's no reason for you not to get that compromise shot before that happens.
As we dive deeper into photography, I do want to pull a quote from a piece you sent me that you wrote for Ebony.com. Cell phone and tablet cameras, digital cameras with their automatic settings and implied credibility have made it difficult for the professional to maintain relevance. Just because someone has the tools, that doesn't mean that they have the same point of view and style.
Digital photography is like being Spider-Man. It's a blessing and a curse. It has opened up the world for so many photographers who didn't have access to film cameras. Digital cameras are a lot more affordable than they were when I started back in 2003, 2004. I started with a Canon 10D. It's the name of the camera. And the camera, that was the it camera of the day. That was something that, if you show them a Canon 10D, they'd be like, can I touch this camera? I've heard stories of this. I didn't know anyone would actually buy it. Can I look at it and hold it for a second? And I'll promise to give it back to you. It was that camera. Now, digital photography, shooting with your cell phone cameras, open up the world for amateur photographers who have talent, who necessarily didn't have the money or the access to those things. At the same time, it's also a bad thing because now everybody with a camera who thinks they're a photographer, we are losing certain aspects of photography, like being an action photographer, or like even being a portrait photographer, where, you know, there's certain skill sets that are developed over time that were really developed when things were harder, when you had to kind of think about things more, when you didn't have automatic settings, when you had to manually expose things. I've had less jobs as a portrait photographer because most of my clients have been event driven. They've been, you know, shooting for a newspaper or a magazine where you don't have a lot of time. Portrait photography is something where you can literally stop time. You can have someone sit down. You can actually make the lights how you want them to be. There's no one's going to be stepping in front of you to kind of block your shot. And it really kind of comes down to the creativity of the photographer. If you're shooting a headshot, that's a headshot. What are you going to do? If you're an editorial photographer, you're shooting for a newspaper, you're shooting for a magazine, you can actually infuse your point of view. You can actually infuse how you see the world in a very real way that you can as an action photographer, but it's not, again, there's compromise with action photographer. There's less compromise with portrait photography. So you can actually infuse your point of view. When I say point of view, I'm talking the same thing as you hear an editorial writer. An editorialist writes their point of view. It's not fact-driven. It's more opinion-based. Photographers have the same thing. This is something that a lot of people actually don't know. An editorial photographer shows you what he or she wants you to see. That's having an opinion. That's showing your point of view.
Earlier this year, the InkSpot had the all illustration issue. One last piece of visual media to consider here. Where do comic books fit into your finding of your own voice? I ask this because they've been a big part of my formation as well. Ironic, given I work in audio.
Right. You know, I learned how to read by reading comic books. It wasn't thrust upon me in a very dramatic way. I didn't want to read Cat in the Hat. And then my mom got me, maybe my dad got me. I don't know. I never asked. But Richie Rich, you know, Heathcliff, Batman, Spider-Man. Like, I learned how to read, reading the word bubbles, taking them to my mom. What is this word? What does this mean? Okay, then going back and reading some more, hitting a wall because I don't know a word, and going back, and that's actually how I learned to read. So for me, comic books have always kind of been there, but they in a very honest way, in a way that I did not know when I was, you know, 3-4 years old. When now that I'm 41, comic books kind of represent the totality of everything that I do. Whether I'm a writer, photographer, I've done design work, I've done video, I've been a filmmaker, I've done voiceover work. You know, the comic books are everything other than you can't hear what they're saying. There's a lot of nuance with comic book storytelling that people aren't familiar with. There's a lot of freedom. You can tell these crazy, insane stories without really spending any money. You can make Star Wars and it will cost you the price of printing. Going to Kinko's. Like, you don't have to like have $1 million budget to make your own comic book Star Wars graphic novel opus. You can just do it and just say whatever it costs is whatever it costs to print. So I tend, as a comic book person, I tend to follow writers. So I love Grant Morrison because of his insane creativity. He has a character, he didn't create this character, but he really kind of took off on it, where Flex Metello, he has this great graphic novel about Flex Metello, where Flex Metello is a superhero who can do things to you by how he flexes his muscles. Now, that sounds like the craziest idea ever. Grant Morrison approaches this like, no, this is a real thing. And you completely believe that a man, like the Superman film, Do You Believe a Man Can Fly? He made you believe a man can flex you to submission by hitting the right calf muscle in his leg. He can knock you out. He doesn't have to punch you. He can just flex you to death. That's Grant Morrison. That's his style. That's his point of view. That's more or less my style, is taking these kind of absurd ideas and making them relatable for other people, whether it's through honesty, whether it's through conversational relatable dialogue that, you know, maybe your dad has spoken to, that my dad has definitely spoken to me. That's what I got from Grant. So I, again, as a comic book aficionado, I tend to follow the writers, and the art is great. Art's king. No one buys a comic book if it has crappy art, but I'm definitely buying a comic book if Grant Morrison writes it.
Everything we've talked about to this point, developing your voice, finding your point of view as a storyteller, how has that all come together in being a managing editor?
Well, the first thing, you have to publish what you want and how you want to do it. You have to kind of tell the stories you want to tell. Case in point, the illustration issue was something I personally wanted to read. I wanted to see in print, and I wanted to have other people see it. I just selfishly said, you know what? I'm just going to take one for the team here. I'm going to pay for half the illustration. I'm going to find money for the other half. And then I'm going to ask everybody to give me the homie rate. And then I'm just going to see this thing because I want to see it. And I'm just really blessed to have people kind of respond to it the way they did. Same thing with a lot of our other issues in the paper we've done. We always, every 2 or 3 months, we'll do a themed issue. So we've done music, we've done education. We had the all innovation issue, and we had the all criminal justice issue. Criminal justice being really important to me. I went to school initially to be an FBI agent. I went to school for a double major, criminal justice, computer science. Really wanted to, I couldn't be Batman. So I'm like, I'm going to do the next best thing. I'm not going to be a cop. I'm going to be an FBI agent. So I've had some freedom in terms of kind of creating the stuff I want to create. But ultimately, you're dealing with a Black-owned newspaper in Fort Wayne, Indiana, falling on the heels of another Black-owned newspaper that went out of business because of a variety of reasons, one of which is the realities of the publishing industry in 2019. It's really hard to kind of sustain a smaller print, small market newspaper. They're dropping off every day of the week. Even the big boys are kind of dying. Someone sent an email to us, to me and John, our publisher, saying thank you for being around because the Defender is no longer there. And that's scary. It's like, what are you going to do? So there's going to be some compromises. We got a small staff. So many stories, so many things that I want to do that I can't do. I have to compromise. I compromise every issue. There's stories that I want to spend more time on. There's stories that I want to investigate. It's almost like being a photographer. At some point, you're just going to have to make the best paper that you can at that point. And then you have, it's like being a basketball player. You have the next play is right around the corner. Those 2 weeks that we have in between the paper being published comes really fast. So you have another 2 weeks to kind of make amends if you can. But a lot of times you're trying to make amends. You're trying to do something. You're trying to recover for something. And you can't do it because something else comes up. And then you're dealing with the small press. You're dealing with like tracking down subscriptions. I am unfortunately the managing editor, but I'm also a part of the sales team. I'm also delivering the paper, as is my publisher, who's also part of the sales team. We're everybody's doing multiple jobs, and you can't possibly spend that much time on one thing except the illustration issue. That you can spend 9 months on that, and that's cool.
The Ink Spot goes to print every other week. I couldn't help but think of WBOI's monthly news roundups. When you aren't publishing daily, you can't be as nimble in how quickly you respond to current events. But if you can find a sweet spot, you can give time to different points of view in so many different and creative ways. I know when Julia interviewed you earlier this year, she joked about going weekly, but what are some of the ways that the 2-week rotation sweet spot has allowed you to be more creative?
We need a 2-week break. Someone even mentioned earlier that maybe you guys should go monthly. Well, that's no longer, I don't think monthly is going to work, but having a biweekly schedule is perfect for us. There's no real need to cover every event that comes up. If we miss an event, we can push it out to the next issue and write a little bit longer story about it versus just mentioning in the paper. What do you want to do? Just mention a blurb in the paper and kill yourself to get those blurbs in on time? Or would you rather take a break, go see some family members, smell some flowers, and then cover it in a longer story for the next issue? I'm going to go for the latter every time.
Brian, thank you so much for being a part of Season 2 of WBOI Presents In Session, and thank you for the point of view you bring to our community through the Fort Wayne Ink Spot.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. Find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our sound effects are by John Dawkins. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Thank you for listening.